This is the show your pastor warned you about.
Where's the beef?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, your host on Stand to Reason. Glad to be with you today, this beautiful Sunday after the 4th, which would be actually be the 6th, which is my mother's birthday. She's 79 today. I talked to her on the phone, and she's still at the cabin. Coughing and sputtering from the gift we gave her, our whole family, bequeathed our cold to her, and so she's recovering just as I am, almost fully recovered. Thankfully, we've got 2 hours ahead of us of careful thinking and discussion on the most important things that you can think about or discuss: ethics and values and religion, the ultimate truths of reality. We're trying to do it in a careful, even-handed fashion, and we're trying to figure out what is true about those things, the way the world really is on the things that really matter. If you'd like to participate in our show, the number is 1-800-227-5278. And if you're here in Southern California, particularly in Orange County, the 714 area code, you can just dial direct, 754-4150. The enforcer, Melinda Penner, is standing by, and we'll be opening up the lines shortly. Are they open now? No. Well, they will be short within the next couple of minutes. She's enforcing things around the studio here right now, but she'll be getting to the phones shortly. So give us a call, 1-800-227-5278. And if you're in the 714 area code, you can dial direct at 754-4150. And I'd love to talk with you. By the way, the rule here is that you give me a piece of your mind. You can talk about anything in these broad areas. You can raise an issue, ask a question. You can agree, disagree, whatever, something you've heard about in the past. That's fine with me. But you have to give me a piece of your mind, because I'm going to do my best to give you a piece of mine in the process of trying to determine the truth about whatever issue that we're discussing, even if the issue is whether or not there's any truth to discuss at all on these matters. Mm-hmm. Last week, I was asked a question by a friend that I'd not seen in a while, and the question was whether or not I was really a Calvinist, as she had heard. And if so, was I a five-point Calvinist? Now, I usually avoid the term Calvinist for a different term that is almost synonymous with it, and that is the term Reformed faith or Reformed theology. The reason I do is because people have a kind of knee-jerk reaction to the term Calvinism. And I think this is part of what was motivating her question to me, partly because I know there we have a mutual friend who is also a Calvinist, or calls himself that, and he is of a more extreme variety, and it's actually his kind of views that cause concern in people when they hear the word Calvinist. And so I tried to clarify for her what I actually meant by the fact that I was a Calvinist. By the way, when someone asks, are you a five-point Calvinist, my response is there is no other kind. That if you understand the convictions of those who are reformed in their thinking about salvation, which these so-called 5 points actually relate to and refer to, the issue of salvation, if you understand them accurately, you realize that they are all held together by a common concept that J.I. Packer has put this way: God saves sinners. That's the single point of Calvinism. But I'm not here to persuade you about Calvinism. I'm here to answer a question for all of you that was asked of me by my friend that has to do with the question of freedom and sovereign grace. And I also want to qualify this to say I'm speaking now to remove an objection, I think, to those who hold views like I do. It's a curiosity, maybe a point of confusion, so I'm going to try to clarify something and maybe remove this objection in your mind, again, not to cause you or to persuade you to become a Calvinist. but just to remove this objection. The second thing I need to say is that though I am a Calvinist, I'm speaking for myself here, not for Stand to Reason, because as an organization, we don't take a position on this. You'll not find it in our statement of faith. It's not a requirement for employment or anything like that. In fact, I actually don't know what all the views are of other people that work for us, and I know there has been a range. So just to clarify that particular point. But the real question that was being asked was a question about the nature of choice. Usually people who stumble over Calvinism or Reformed theology presume that in Calvinism there is no meaningful choice. In other words, if you're a Calvinist, then you're a determinist. Your life, your actions are determined by the sovereign choice of God. Everything is determined. And some who are, I would consider, more unbalanced or extreme or mistaken in their application of the principles of sovereignty often sound that way, and that puts the scare into some people. And my friend was concerned, I think, because if a decision is not free, and then it's determined, and if you're determined, you're a Calvinist because you don't believe in freedom. I mean, this is what it amounts to. How can an act of faith be free and still be caused by, in some sense, and fully secured by God Himself? So you have these things at opposite poles: freedom of choice, and the view that in some sense God causes, in whatever sense it is, it secures salvation for an individual. So ultimately, God is the one who's responsible for who falls underneath the provisions of His grace, and not the individual. So this creates a kind of conundrum. And I think the vital question at this point is, what does it mean for a decision to be free? And this is a question that many people have never really thought about. And the reason they haven't thought about it is because they think they understand that there are only simple alternatives. They're obvious. There are only two. We are either determined, we're puppets on a string making mechanical decisions, completely dictated from the outside, kind of like one domino falling against the other, on the one hand, or we're not determined and we're free. And if the choice for salvation is ours, as the Bible seems to indicate in many places, then we must be free and not determined. But Calvinism teaches that the choice is God's, and He decides who's going to be saved, and therefore, it seems, Calvinists then do not believe in freedom. Instead, they believe in determinism. And so, my friend, I think, was surprised to find out that I was a Calvinist, a real Calvinist, a five-pointer, because I think she didn't express it in so many words, but my sense was that she thought that this meant that I was a determinist. And that seemed odd from her perspective for me to be, the way she had known me and thought about me and was aware of my thinking and everything. So I wanted to take a moment to try to make some sense out of this, because I am a Calvinist because of what the Bible teaches. I am convinced that grace is sovereign. It is free, a free gift of God, and it is distributed sovereignly by God. But I am also aware that the Bible acknowledges choices that we make, and I believe in that too, and that seems to be a conundrum. Until you realize that the options are not simply between freedom and determinism, because the concept of freedom, let me put it this way, this line of thinking, though common, leaves out an important detail. And the detail is that there are two different ways to understand freedom, that there are two different species, if you will, of genuine freedom. And in fact, both kinds of freedom seem to be part of our daily experience. And these two distinctions are very important for our discussion. And by the way, and it's this distinction that is the thing that people haven't thought very much about. So let me stimulate your thinking by asking you a couple of questions. First, do you choose to sin? Now, I know you sin. We all do. It's the human condition. My question is, when you sin, do you choose to do so? Is it because of a choice you are making to do wrong? That's the first question. The second question is, can you, as a human being, choose never to sin in your life? I mean, in the natural condition, are you capable of sinlessness? Now, my suspicion is that when you ponder those two questions, first, do you choose to sin? Is it your choice? And secondly, is it possible for you to choose never to do so, that you will answer yes to the first one and no to the second. Now, not only are those answers consistent with our personal experience, but those answers are consistent with the Scripture. We are in a state of fallenness in which we sin in virtue of the fact that we are sinners. There is no option for us not to sin, even though we are aware that we choose to sin. And in light of our choice to sin, are held responsible for those sins that we choose. Now, let me ask you one other question. Did you choose what you ate for breakfast this morning? And if you did, could you have chosen to eat something else if you had willed it so? Now, I think your answer to both of those questions is yes. I chose to eat peanut butter, whole wheat toast with jam. It's kind of my standard breakfast, the first thing I get in the morning. And I had it with coffee. Now, I chose that. Now, I don't always choose that. I sometimes choose oatmeal. And I sometimes choose it bacon and eggs. And when I was in Wisconsin, I had bratwurst with eggs. That's a super treat. So I could have chosen otherwise in the decision I made about my breakfast this morning, and I suspect so could you have. So when it comes to lots of things, breakfast, for example, and a whole host of other things, we can make choices in a way that it seems possible we could have made other choices. We could have done otherwise. But it also seems that there are some other choices, maybe a much smaller group of choices, that we don't have that kind of freedom. And I would put in this category, since based on, I suspect, what your answers to those first two questions were, choosing sin and could you have done otherwise, that rebellion against God that results in acts of sin against him are examples of the second kind of freedom. That is, things that you choose that you could not have done otherwise. And here I don't mean that you could not have done otherwise of that, maybe in this particular act of sin. Sometimes you could say, oh, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to resist temptation. And by the way, you can do that without the Holy Spirit. There are people who resist temptation even though they don't have the Holy Spirit. This is an act of human will could accomplish that. But no act of human will is going to allow you to do that all the time, is it? Your choice is inevitable that someday, sometime, many times actually it turns out in our lives, we sin. Even though the choice is inevitable, it's still our choice, isn't it? It's choices that we make, and therefore we are responsible for them. Now, I want you to think about this. Doesn't this suggest that there are two different ways for an act to be free? One, an act is free if we choose it ourselves. In other words, it's our choice. The only condition for this kind of freedom is that we make the decision. Nobody's forcing us. There isn't some condition on the outside that requires us to act this way. We are not being dragged along or compelled by some exterior kind of influence. We are free on the single condition that we choose the thing we choose of our own will and volition. And that's one sense of freedom. But there's another sense of freedom that has that condition to it, but adds a condition. In this second sense of freedom, an act is free if we choose it, in the sense that I just mentioned, and now comes a second condition, and we could have done otherwise. Now, philosophers call that libertarian freedom, generally, although there's some debate about the nature of that term. Generally, an act isn't free unless we choose it, and we could have done otherwise. So, it seems that the choices are a little bit more complicated than we thought at the beginning. It isn't just determinism on the one hand and freedom on the other. It is determinism on the one hand, puppets on a string, dominoes falling in a deterministic fashion, one after the other, or freedom in one of two or both senses. A choice that we make ourselves and couldn't have done otherwise, but it's still our choice, because we wanted to do it, and so we chose it. Or a choice that we make ourselves, and though we wanted to do it and chose it, theoretically, we could have done otherwise. Now, I want you to think about those two options when you think about what the Bible teaches about sin and salvation. The Calvinist reads his Bible and sees that human beings are now in a state of fallenness and rebellion against God. In the natural condition, now, we have our hearts set against God. Our wills are inclined against Him. It's not that we cannot choose God, that some external thing is preventing us from exercising our choice, but that we will not. That we are determined. You want to say bound and determined. You know how we use that term. He was bound and determined to do what he wanted to do. Now, when we use that term bound and determined, we use it figuratively, that there was no course of action that was left for him because his will was set in a particular way. He was going to choose that no matter what. And we are bound and determined in that sense. We are steadfastly and immovably in defiance of God. Read Romans 1 if you're uncertain. 1, 2, 3, if you're uncertain about that biblical fact. And that every time we exercise our free choice against God, we do so in a way that is consistent with our anger and hostility and rebellion against Him. In other words, when we exercise our freedom, we choose what we want to do as fallen human beings. We always choose against God. Our freedom, then, is the problem. It's not the solution. So, with all men bent against God, what is God's response? Their now natural inclination is rebellion. They are not inclined in any sense, and because of that, will not in any sense choose to follow God. Now what? God rescues us from our rebellion by sovereignly changing our nature and reinclining our wills. In other words, He changes the direction of our hearts so that instead of choosing from a rebellious inclination, we choose from an inclination that seeks God and His forgiveness. And this act of God is an act of mercy and grace on our behalf that we did not deserve. Now, here's the kicker. He does not do that for every person. And why He doesn't, I don't know, but the difference between those He does it for and those He does not do it for is the difference between the elect and non-elect. Because if men were left to their own devices, they would all continue in their rebellion, because that is now, since the fall, their nature. They would continue to freely choose in the first sense of freedom that we discussed, according to the inclination that is hostile towards God, and no one would be in heaven, and Christ would have no bride. Therefore, God chooses from among the rebellious who are under condemnation appropriately because of their choice to rebel and sin against God. So when God punishes them, it's not God's fault because he doesn't elect them. It's their fault because they chose rebellion and sin. So when God works in that fashion, he is rescuing them from themselves. God chooses the rebellious who are under condemnation and elects from those who are hopelessly lost a company of human beings who would be a bride for his son. And he miraculously transforms their natures. He heals them so that now they choose the right option, forgiveness, instead of the wrong option, rebellion. Therefore, God is able to guarantee the result, a bride for his son, an act of mercy towards those who don't deserve it. He does it in a way, he guarantees it in a way, that allows men to freely choose restoration with God in the same way that they freely chose rebellion against God. They freely chose rebellion because it was consistent with their nature, and they acted consistent with their nature, and it was their choice, so it was free in that sense. And when God changed that nature by an act of grace, those who he chose responded consistent with that and freely choose him now. And that is how an act of faith can be free and still be caused and fully secured by God. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area, code 754-4150. Lines are open. I'm Greg Kokel, waiting to talk with you on Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research, or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2-REASON, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON.
Demonstrating once again that Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas, Greg Kokel with Stand to Reason. Of course, it's not just me who does that. It's the whole team at STR, our speakers, our website people, the whole team. We're working together to help you. Website, str.org, really simple. Stand to Reason, the acronym is str.org. And, of course, that's where you can get our, like, 900 pages and counting of information about everything you can imagine about ethics, values, and religion. And you can also download our podcast, you know, subscribe, and we'll send it right to you, your doorstep, as it were. Store is on there, all kinds of stuff. It's, you know, a blog. I mean, it's one-stop shopping, so to speak, for your thoughtful Christianity. Let's go to the phones, and this is Bachelor Springs, Kansas. That would be Patrick. Hey, Pat.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
Is there really a place called Bachelor Springs?
It's called Baxter Springs, Kansas.
Oh, Baxter. Okay, yeah. Got it. Well, that makes more sense. Baxter Springs.
Yeah.
Okay. The enforcer didn't catch it right. She wrote Bachelor Springs, so okay. What's on your mind, Patrick?
Well, I work at a place called Burgraff Tire here in Baxter Springs, Kansas. And
Burger what?
Burgraff Tire is called B-U-R-G-R-A-F-F, Burgraff Tire.
Oh, okay, tire, okay, as in car tires.
Yeah.
Okay.
But one of the questions that a guy brought up to me was, the Bible says that God has that God knows us before he basically knew us while he stitched us in our mother's womb, right?
Right, right.
And he was saying that, you know, since God did that for us, then he knows what his plans are for us for our life before we even make our plans for us.
That's right.
And so he was saying, well, then wouldn't we automatically be saved if he's done that for us when we're coming into the world?
I don't know how that reasoning follows. First of all, you gave three steps there. First mm-hmm. one is that God knows us in the womb. Second, therefore, he knows the plans that he has, that he's made for us. And third, therefore, wouldn't we be saved? Actually, none of those follow. The first one is true because the Scripture teaches that. Okay, it doesn't follow, though, that because he knows us in the womb, therefore he knows the plans that he's made for us. God knows the plans he's made for us before there was ever anyone in the womb. And he knows that in virtue of his omniscience. In fact, there never was when he didn't know everything that was ever going to take place, including his sovereign designs. So, I mean, the second point is true, but not for the reason of the first point, if you will. But even so, God knows all of those things about everyone. And I don't know how the fact that God knows everything that's going to happen to everyone would mean, therefore, that everyone would be the recipients of his grace, his saving grace. I don't see that step. The person says, wouldn't it be the case then that everyone would be saved if God knew everybody in the womb? And my response is, why would you ever think that?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't see how that even follows. Now,
I didn't either.
Well, and that'd be fair for you to ask him, how does that, in a sense, conclusion follow from the point that you made? Even though God is... Now, it might be because the phrase or the concept of God knowing some person, depending on where this is stated, refers to God's sovereign election of that person. So when it says God foreknows us, he foreknows us, I don't think that it means that is foreknowledge of decisions that we make or things that will happen, because there the wording isn't foreknows decisions, rather he foreknows us. So there are sometimes when this concept of knowing us beforehand suggests the saving relationship that those who are Christ's own have with him. Other times, it's just simply making reference to the fact that God has a knowledge of our personal selves before we are born. And I think that makes it very clear that our personal selves exist before our birth. Even though our body is being formed, we are still ourselves at the time, and God knows us then. And so but salvation is not in view there. God knows everyone in that sense. He is acquainted with every human individual directly, even though they are not yet born, because they exist at that point at which he is acquainted with them. So, but that doesn't suggest that they are somehow then forgiven of the crimes that they are going to be committing against him.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes a little bit more clear.
Yeah, the main point here, Patrick, is just to, he seems to suggest that if God knows us, then it naturally follows that everyone that he knows is going to be saved. And
yeah.
I don't know why that's the case. Look, let's just say you work with a lot of different guys, right?
Yes, I work with about 9 different guys.
Okay, let's just say, and what's the name of the gentleman that you're talking to?
His name is Timmy.
Okay, Timmy?
Yeah.
Okay, let's just say you're talking to Timmy, and you say, Timmy, I know everybody in here, all the other 8 guys and you, but you're the only one I'm going to give my new car to.
Mm-hmm.
So you can separate out Timmy for a special gift, your new car, or if we want to put it in different terms, you could separate Timmy out. I think I want to change my metaphor. Well, let's finish that one out. So you could know all these other guys, but be a special friend to Timmy. All right.
Yeah.
So that's, even though you know these other, here's a better illustration, more akin to this, because let's say you know 9 other girls. Are you married?
No, I am actually single. I'm 19 years old.
Oh, okay. Well, let's just pretend there's a gal that you got your eye on that you marry. She's your wife, all right? So you have maybe 9 other girls you could have chosen, or 8 other girls, but she's the one you chose. So you know the rest of them, but isn't it the case that now when you're married to her, you know her in a much more personal, intimate way, and you come under the protection, she comes under the protection of you and your home and your household? So in a sense, you know your wife, and she has certain benefits that others that you know in a different way don't have. And I think the same kind of thing applies with that phrase, God knowing us. God can know all kinds of people in that he is, in a sense, acquainted with them. But it's different when he chooses one to become a member of his personal family and then knows them in that more intimate sense. Does that make sense as a metaphor?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. So, Send that answer back to your buddy and see what he says to that. Okay.
Okay.
Timmy. All right, Patrick. Appreciate your call. 1-800-227-5278. A line is open. Let's go to Victorville and David. Welcome back, David.
Hey, Greg. How are you?
I'm doing all right. We talked. Was it last week?
Last week. Yeah.
Okay. And I've thought a bit about our conversation, but you were not able to get to your basic question.
No, that's why I called back. But one thing I wanted to just interject with, the one that I always use with respect to foreknowing us and knowing us is you're a father, right? You have you have a couple girls, right?
I do.
Yeah. Have they started learning how to ride bikes yet?
One rides a tricycle.
One ride, and the other one obviously doesn't. Then.
Well, at 6 months.
Yeah,
probably.
It's
actually, she's
yeah.
7 months in 4 days.
Yeah, it's kind of hard there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But they back up pretty easy. The way I like to use the analogy is that as a father, you know one of these days your little girl is going to learn to ride a two-wheel bicycle,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to have training wheels on it. Well, you as a father one of these days are going to be forced in the unenviable position of taking the training wheels off the bike. Now, the little girl that you have or the little child that you have is going to fall and scrape their knee.
Mm-hmm.
That's inevitable. It's going to happen. But are you the cause of it because you took the training wheels off?
Mm.
Or is your little girl responsible because she took the initiative to learn how to ride a bike with two wheels?
So is this an illustration that has to do with my opening commentary or it has to do with Patrick's comment?
Just Patrick's comment, and really with the whole notion of free choice. God, love, and God do not work with 4 things, and that's force, fear, intimidation, and manipulation. Those are the things that we teach in the prison ministry that I'm a part of.
Okay. Well, your comments seem to have to do more with my opening commentary than Patrick, because Patrick's had to do just simply with God. If God knows us in the womb, why are we not all saved? So,
well, no, it's the same thing. In other words, we only choose to be saved when we get on the two-wheeler. We know we're going to fall. We're going to fall regardless. Whether we get on the two-wheeler or not, we're going to fall. Salvation, you can look at as riding a two-wheel bicycle, however, in my mind.
Okay, I got your point.
Okay.
I don't agree with it, but I'm not going to pursue that because that's not your question. So
no,
let's get to Luke 16.
My question was Luke chapter 16, verses right. 19 through 31, the parable of Lazarus and the rich man. A lot of Christians look at this as a window or a picture into eternal, life.
Well, they look at it as a description of something that is real, even though obviously there are metaphoric elements to it.
Right.
And that it is not introduced by the writer Luke as a parable. Jesus doesn't introduce it as a parable, but it reads like it's an account. And it's
sure.
And if it's not an account of something really happening, at least in its broad, the broad description of the event, then it's hard to imagine what Jesus' point could possibly be. If there wasn't really afterlife a place where those who were rebels against God go in agony, and there's a gulf that's fixed that those who are not rebels against God are being comforted, and the gulf can't be bridged, and that even if people come back from the dead, it doesn't mean that people are going to believe in order to change their ways and avoid the fate that fell to the rich man in this illustration. I mean, if the broad strokes of this are not actually literal, there's not a genuine truth there, then it's hard to imagine what point Jesus was trying to make with the parable.
Right.
So your question is?
Well, my question is who are specifically, when Jesus mentions in the parable, when he mentions, I have five brethren, who are those five brethren in your mind?
I don't know.
You have absolutely no idea?
I have absolutely no idea. They are the brothers of Lazarus, one dead rich man, who he fears for their eternal destiny, and there's nothing else in the text that gives us any reason to believe it's anything different than that. Unless you've got something clever up your sleeve here.
Oh sure, I've got plenty.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Exactly. Have you've read Genesis 29 and 30, right?
I can't tell you exactly what they're in. Why don't you just tell me what your point is instead of asking the questions like that? You're making a point with the question, so I'd rather you just said the questions straight out, and I'll respond to them.
Sure, not a problem.
So you think the five people are, the five brothers are?
They're the five literal blood brothers of Judah, the tribe of Judah. If you go to Genesis 29 and 30, if you read those chapters between Jacob and Rachel, they had six boys.
So this is this person in Luke 16 then must be Judah, who is suffering.
Has to be.
Does it have to be?
Well, because first of all, it says a certain rich man.
All right. So
now you were saying that parables don't start off that way, but if you go to chapters 15 and 16, you'll see that, for example, in the prodigal son, it starts a certain man.
Okay.
If you go to the unjust steward, it starts a certain man.
Right. And so, then there are other, but there are other, I didn't say parables don't start out that way. What I said is this is not identified by Jesus or the writer as a parable. So it's quite possible that this could be an actual thing that Jesus is describing. But if it turns out just to be a story of sorts that Jesus is describing, if you don't take the basic terms of this account in a fairly straightforward fashion, then the question is, what point is Jesus actually making? That is accessible to his audience. And I promise you, the people he was talking to were not thinking 2,000 years back in time to Judah, who had five brothers.
Well, see, that's the problem, is that the Pharisees would have thought they knew everything there was about Scripture. Jesus was actually pointing out to them by saying, I have five brothers. They would have known who those five brothers were. They would have known instinctively. They were not.
Okay, I don't know why anyone, Jew or otherwise, fully understanding the Old Testament at all, would inexorably assume that these five brothers were Judah's five brothers. I see nothing in the context that gives the slightest indication of such a thing.
Well,
and just because 2,000 years before, in the literature of the Jews' revelation, they have a man with five brothers. By the way, Judah didn't have five brothers. He actually had 11.
It's so, five blood brothers. I specifically said five blood brothers.
Oh, okay. Does it use the term blood brother here?
Doesn't have to. Doesn't
well,
have
it
to.
Doesn't. Okay. Okay. So tell
no,
me. All right. Fine.
For example,
okay. Wait. I want to know, David, what your point is. So let's say you believe this is Judas Brothers, and what follows from that precarious notion?
Well, the point that I'm trying to get across here is that when Jesus says a certain rich man clothed in purple and fine linen, that statement alone would have pointed a finger at the very people that he was talking to, which, if you'll look at verses 15 through 18, actually verses 14 through 18, he specifically slaps them in the face about, hey, wake up.
I agree.
Got something to tell you.
I agree. He is telling this, giving this account to the Pharisees because they need to learn something that is taught in this account. Mm-hmm. Whether or not Judah and his five blood brothers are in view here seems to be irrelevant to the point. So why is this so important to you?
Well, it's important to me because what it clearly shows is that Jesus was speaking in a way that is clearly identified as a parable. In other words, a parable was spoken for only those that would understand.
Wait. I don't get it. If you think he is talking about an historical individual who had five blood brothers, how could this possibly be a parable? It seems to me it makes just the opposite point.
No,
that he's giving a talk about a certain rich man that they would all know from their past history. That's what you just told
them. That's the point.
But that's what you were just telling.
They didn't know.
All right. So therefore, what follows from that? Let's just say we accept that as being the case, and therefore your conclusion is?
Well, it's very obvious if you read the rest of that.
Tell me what the obvious conclusion that I have missed is.
The obvious conclusion from the fact that the five brethren are being talked about clearly shows that it's not a story about life and death and death and everything with respect to the hereafter. Quite the contrary. It's actually Jesus is using what they believe from mythology. They did not learn this from Moses. Jesus is clearly showing them that from what they learned from mythology, that even if one came back from the dead, and we know who that one was that came back from the dead, they would not be persuaded because they did not understand Moses or the prophet.
Well, it seems like he wasted a whole lot of language talking about impassable gulfs and torment and just let him put a little water on my lips so I could be eased from this torment. He spaced a lot of words that had nothing to do with the point that you think he was making.
Well, the point is, with respect to that, is Jesus knew that one little single solitary drop of water on the tongue wouldn't cool anything. Yet the Pharisees of his day believed in the ancient Greek mythology taught by Plato that men, when they died, either went to a place of internal torment or a place of heavenly bliss.
Okay, wait, let me
Jesus
just...
Jesus was using what they believed
okay.
to show them how false what they it is what they believe.
Okay, fair enough. We got your point. And apparently all these Jewish rabbis were Platonic scholars, you know, and not biblical scholars. And, well, I don't know. You keep saying clearly. It's clear as mud to me, at least the legitimacy of your point. But I appreciate you calling back and making your case. More to come here at Stand to Reason. Stay with us, 1-800-227-5278.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Standing to Reason for Classical Christianity and Classical Christian Values. Got lost there for a minute. Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. 1-800-227-5278. 754-4150 if you're in the 714 area code. By the way, I started out talking about an enigma relating to choice and God's sovereignty that applies to Calvinism or Reformed theology, and I spend a considerable amount of time trying to at least clear up that enigma. And I did say that the only kind of Calvinist that's a real Calvinist is a five-point Calvinist, because these ideas are all kind of woven together. All the alleged 5 points or so-called 5 points of Calvinism are really part of 1 point, and that 1 point is that God saves sinners. And all those points kind of follow from that. The one that trips people up the most, though, is even those who might be sympathetic to unconditional election, is the limited atonement, or the so-called limited atonement. Not the best choice of words, I think. But when we start out the second hour, I'm going to address that a bit, too. So stay with us, and if you're curious as to my characterization of that, I'll offer that to you at the beginning of the hour. Let's go to Akron, Ohio, and Dornan. Hello, Dornan.
Jordan, actually.
Oh, Jordan.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for correcting me. Sorry about that. Okay, Jordan.
Yes.
What's on your mind today, Jordan?
Okay. My friend of mine suggested a book to me called Four Views on Hell.
Uh-huh.
And it's by four different theological professors at different seminaries and such around the country.
Yeah, I like those, two views, three views, four views books. There's a whole bunch of them, and it's great because what you do is you get different perspectives and you get interaction between the authors. So there's kind of like a productive peer review going on of these ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine this – I don't think I have this particular book. I got a bunch of the other ones, but I imagine this one is much like that. Who are the authors, the four guys?
The authors are John Walford.
Yeah.
William Crockett.
Dallas Seminary.
Mm-hmm. Zachary Hayes.
Don't know him.
Clark Pinnock.
Oh, Clark Pinnock. Okay. I do know who he is. All right. Who was the fourth one? Zachary Hayes, Clark Pinnock, Walford, and
– William Crockett.
Oh, William Crockett, did you say? I don't
know
him.
He's a professor of New Testament at Alliance Theological Seminary.
Okay, great. Well, I know what we're probably Clark Pinnock is going to go with, but I'm glad that he's in there because he offers a very different view. Go ahead, and what's your question about that?
Okay. My question is, the four views that it points out in here is the literal view, the metaphorical view, the purgatorial view, and the conditional view. My question is, what is your particular view on hell and why?
Okay. Literal, metaphorical, purgatorial, and what was the last one?
Conditional.
Would that be Clark Pinnock, the conditional?
Let me see here. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I think Clark Pinnock is an annihilationist, isn't he?
Yes, I believe so. so.
Okay. Well, I'm not that. Annihilationism, apparently the conditional view of hell, is the idea that God doesn't send anybody to hell. What he does is he annihilates people. So the people that remain existing don't get punished, you know, are the ones that are in heaven, and the ones that don't qualify for heaven for whatever reason, and Pinnock is quite liberal in this regard, still there are some people who may not make it, and then they just get destroyed. And by the way, there are some evangelicals who hold this view. I think it's wrong, but I don't think the scripture supports it. I think people who hold that view are motivated by a tender heart, which I think Clark Pinnock has, and they just can't bear the thought of people suffering forever at the hand of a just God, that no loving God would do this.
Right.
I think the testimony of the scriptures is quite the opposite. I'm not surprised that this kind of comes from an Arminian. For myself, as a Reformed person, a Calvinist, you know, there's a certain part of me that completely kind of rejects this or rebels against this notion. I think the reason that God, that the people suffer forever in hell is not just because they deserve it, but because it glorifies God. Consequently, that's why he doesn't elect everybody when
right.
he might have. You know, so I think that anyway, okay. So I reject that notion. If literal means that every statement about hell is precisely and literally accurate without metaphor or figure, that hell is a place where teeth are gnashing together, where worms never die, where the fire burns forever. Yet there is eternal darkness. Then I don't hold the literal view, because a pit where people are tortured. The tormentors is a term used to describe the, you know, let the tormentors have him, you know, kind of thing. Then I'm not a literalist. Now, lest anyone take umbrage with that and think that I'm somehow selling the Bible short. I think hell is a non-physical place, although I could be wrong about that, because there will be physical bodies in hell. So, I mean, I'm willing to think through that a little bit more. But in any event, it is an extra-dimensional. It is not in any of our dimensions. It isn't like you can travel far enough in a spaceship and find it in the universe somewhere. I don't
right.
think that's the kind of place it is. I think it's extra-dimensional. You might even want to call it another universe if you'd like. But it has no the descriptions, I think, and because it's not of this world, then I think we can see naturally there is going to be a kind of limitation in describing it in terms of this world, all right? And so what the biblical writers have done is they've taken language of this world that was the best language available to them to describe as accurately as possible the horrors of hell. And just like there are anthropomorphisms used to describe God, in other words, God's described like a human being with a body, though he doesn't have one. The arm of the Lord has done this, you know, or something like that.
Right.
By the same token, I think that there is language that is figurative that is used to describe hell. Now, I don't think that takes away anything from the anguish and terror of hell. As one person put it, no, I don't think the terms are literal. I think actually hell is much worse than what those terms describe. I don't know if it's much worse than molten hot things poured on your body or whatever those, but it is meant to express as accurately as possible within the limits of our language in this dimension, if you will, the anguish that will be experienced by those who go to that place. So you don't want to go there.
No.
So I would, I guess I would be a metaphorical person as long as one understands that the metaphors are meant to communicate a literal reality that is at least as bad as the metaphors themselves characterize it, and quite possibly could be worse.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know if the purgatorial view is the Roman Catholic view.
Well, yeah, Zachary Hayes that holds that view. He teaches at theology at the Catholic Theological Union.
Yeah, I don't have any reason to believe. Well, I don't think purgatory exists. There is no cleansing that is required for the Christian. in the sense that Roman Catholics characterize it, though. And they, I think, hijack a passage from Corinthians, you know, that has really nothing to do with purgatory. And that's the only, just about the only biblical reference that they can find to point to it. I think that the book of Hebrews is pretty clear that when Jesus dies for us, he dies for us, he pays our penalty, and he cleanses us from all unrighteousness.
Yeah, we're spotless and blameless.
Yes, and somebody might say, well, we're not actually spotless because we have sinned. We at the glorification, we will be spotless and blameless, and it will be something that is done in virtue of Christ's sacrifice. So,
we've taken the pardon. So,
yes, exactly. And so there is. I think that any reference to purgatory in the Roman Catholic sense shows. I think, and I'm choosing my words carefully, but I think a gross misunderstanding of justification. And, I mean, I think what the Roman Catholic system has done is returned us right back to what the Jews had, basically, at the beginning. And that's a whole other discussion, but, you know, did Jesus die for us or not, and what did that accomplish? It certainly, in my view, doesn't leave any room for some place like purgatory. So, Jordan, I guess I'm a metaphorical guy with the qualification that I offer. Thank you for the question. Hour number two coming right up, and I'll be talking about, at the outset, of the concept of limited, what I prefer to call particular atonement. Stay with us and stand to reason. Greg Kokel back with you here, hour number two, on Stand to Reason, not just teaching you what to think, but how to think. At least that's my goal. Giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday from 3 until 5 on Stand to Reason. 1-800-227-5278. I think that's an 800 line that's still open there. You can try that. If you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150, I'd love to talk to you. I got some folks on the line already. We're going to talk about imperialism and is Jesus eternally the Son and whatever's on your mind. So those are the ones in the queue. I started out the show clarifying a concept that I think is a conundrum for a lot of people who consider the beliefs of Calvinists, or those who are reformed in their convictions about salvation, those that believe in unconditional election, that God is responsible for our salvation if we have it, and we are responsible for our sin, and we have that. And so therefore, those who go to hell because they deserve that, and those who go to heaven by God's mercy, which they don't deserve. And since his mercy is free and his grace is free, he can give it to whomever he wants. He elects a group to give that to, and he secures it for them. And that raises the question of unconditional election and sovereign grace on the one hand, and freedom of choice on the other. And where is there freedom in such a system? And the Bible seems to teach freedom. So how do you bring those two together? And so I spent some time talking about that by nuancing the concept of freedom. I also mentioned that there was only one kind of Calvinist, a five-pointer, and anything less is not really a Calvinist, I think, because all of the five alleged 5 points of Calvinism are tied together: total depravity, unconditional election, irresistible grace, perseverance of the saints, and limited atonement. And there are people who say, well, I'm a 4-point Calvinist because I believe in the other thing, but I don't believe in the limited atonement business, because they are aware that the scriptures teach that Jesus died for all. So how do you make sense of that? And I think this concept of limited atonement has been misunderstood by a lot of people. And in fact, some have pointed out that the concept limited, or I should say the word limited, is the wrong word to use, and that particular would be more precise. And I think you'll see why when I give the explanation that I give on why I believe in limited or particular atonement and why that isn't a problem for me biblically. In fact, you should believe in it too, even if you're not a Calvinist. At least believe in it the way I understand it to be. So the first thing I have to do, though, to make some sense out of this is I have to define a term, and that term is atonement. So let me tell you what I mean by atonement. I know, by the way, that there are a number of different theories of atonement, but I have a particular view in mind, and that is shared, I think, by those who are also Calvinists. We are talking, when we are talking about limited or particular atonement, we are talking about an atonement that is, listen carefully, the payment for sin that is made to avert God's anger towards the sinner. Let me say that again. Atonement is the payment for sin that is made to avert God's anger towards the sinner. So with that definition in mind, a series of questions, because I want to give you an illustration to help you to see how this works together. Since atonement is a payment, I want to talk about the nature of payments. When you pay a bill, is the bill still owed? You send in your check, you give them your credit card number, the check goes through, the credit card company pays the charge. Is the bill still owed? If they come back to you, the restaurant or the business concern or the telephone company or the electrical company, if they come back to you and say, you still owe us, can't you just say, well, look, here's the record of the payment. Since the payment is made, then the bill is no longer owed. Now, that's very straightforward. In other words, when the payment is made for the bill, the debt is canceled. Right? All right, now that's what payment means. So when a sin is actually paid for, and that's our definition of atonement, if it is atoned for, then the sin bill is paid. Right? It's no longer owed. There is a release of the debt. You might say there is a forgiveness of the debt. And with forgiveness, salvation. Therefore, everyone whose sins have been atoned for, those sins have been paid for. And everyone whose sins have been paid for is forgiven. And everyone who is forgiven is going to heaven. Therefore, everyone whose sin has been atoned for is going to heaven. Let me say that again. Everyone whose sin is atoned for is going to heaven, because atonement means paying the bill. Therefore, if atonement is not limited in some sense, then universalism is true. Every human being goes to heaven. If the atonement is not limited in some sense, then everyone gets the atonement. And if everyone gets the atonement, then everyone's sin is atoned for, everyone's sin bill is paid, everyone is forgiven, and everyone goes to heaven. And that's a problem, isn't it? Because it doesn't seem like the Bible teaches that everyone goes to heaven. Some go to heaven and some don't. Some have their crimes paid for by someone else, Jesus, and some don't. And those who don't pay for them themselves. and the place where the payment is made is called hell. So it seems to me that atonement has to be limited in some sense, or else universalism is true. Universalism is not true, therefore atonement must be limited in some sense. But how is atonement limited? That's the key. What is the limitation on atonement? The atonement, in my view, is not limited in its potential, in what it is capable of theoretically doing. Because Jesus was not just a man, but also God, the sacrifice of the God-man was adequate to pay for all sin for all time. And I think this is what all of those verses mean when they talk about Jesus' atonement in any way that might characterize that in biblical language, payment for sin, is for everyone. He died for the sins of the world. What that means is that the payment was adequate for all of those, not that it was applied to all of those. So the atonement is limited not in its potential, but rather in its application. The atonement is applied only to those who God intends it to be applied to, that is, those who have satisfied the right condition. And what is that condition? That condition is faith in Christ. So God does not intend the atonement for everyone, only to those who have satisfied the right condition, and that right condition is faith in Christ. God does not intend the payment to be made for everyone, in which case everyone would be saved, which is universalism. Instead, God intends that the payment or atonement be limited to those who fulfill the conditions for receiving it, faith in Christ. Therefore, the atonement is limited. Now, I, for the life of me, cannot figure out what is so controversial about that. This is a completely straightforward and common sense notion that comports consistently, as I've characterized it here, with all the scriptures that I know about the issue. And by the way, notice that I have not said anything about election yet, in the Calvinistic sense. It seems to me that there is nothing in this characterization of limited or particular atonement, and this is why I like the word particular, because it means that the atonement is particular for those who qualify. There is nothing in this characterization of atonement that should in any way be offensive or disagreeable to someone who does not believe in election in the Reformed or Calvinistic sense. You could be an Arminian and believe in conditional election and still hold that everybody doesn't get saved, and even though the blood of Christ was adequate for everybody, it isn't applied to everybody. It is only applied to those who fulfill the condition, and the condition is faith. Jesus' atonement is limited in application to those who fulfill the conditions for receiving it. Now, the way this has classically been put is the atonement, or the blood of Christ, is sufficient for all, but efficient only for the elect. And by the way, at this point, you can cash out election in any way you want, in the Arminian sense, because even Arminians believe in the elect and election. They just characterize it different. You can cash it out that way, or you can cash it out in the Calvinistic sense. It makes no difference to this understanding of limited atonement. So regardless of whether or not election is conditional, Arminianism, it, in a sense, is conditioned on your faith and you choosing, or unconditional, Calvinism, it is not conditioned on your libertarian free choice. It is only conditioned on God's choice of you, and everything follows from that, regardless of what view you have of election. The atonement must still be limited in its application, or else universalism is true. So this is why I think that the L in the tulip should be the least controversial element, the limited atonement. The TULIP is an acronym for those 5 points I mentioned earlier: total depravity, unconditional election, limited atonement, irresistible grace, and perseverance of the saints. These are the kind of core concepts of Calvinistic understanding of salvation. But the one that people want to leave out, the so-called four-point Calvinists, seems to me to be the least controversial of any of these, unless one is a universalist. So I hope that kind of repairs a breach for you if you are thinking about some of these things and fancy yourself a four-point Calvinist, that now you'll kind of step up to the plate and be a fully furnished Calvinist and accept limited atonement in the way I characterized it, because it does no violence to anything in the Scripture. In fact, it seems that if you reject it, then and that Jesus actually paid for everyone, then the payment has been made, and God can't extract double payment for one crime. It's kind of a double jeopardy. It's not going to happen. That would be unjust. Okay. 1-800-227-5278, and let's go back to the phones. I think we have time for another call. Chris, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A while ago, and it's a fitting question considering it's the fourth holiday, but I was speaking with a friend about the Judeo-Christian philosophy that this country was built upon,
mm-hmm.
and we quickly came into a debate about colonization, imperialism, and whether those are moral.
Right.
It would seem that imperialism or any sort of acquisition of land and resources by conquest is morally comparable to stealing. So from there we began talking about what makes land the property of any one individual or group,
mm-hmm.
i.e., whose was it to begin with in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
Just becomes a little difficult to affirm the value of this country and the person and the principles it was built upon if how it was established was through something that is fundamentally an immoral act.
And there he would, I guess he would characterize the imperialistic actions against Native Americans. Is that right?
Because
America has never been an imperialistic country in the classical model of, say, Great Britain or France or Portugal or some of these others.
Right, exactly. And I was trying to look in to see what the distinction is between imperialism and colonization.
Uh-huh.
So, but even still, it would seem that the colonization of the United States was in a way, I don't know.
Yeah, I wouldn't care. I wouldn't call it colonization so much, although I guess this is the way it started out. That's why they had 13 colonies, but I see it more in terms of conquest. But I think this is a difficult question to answer because there's a couple of things that are in play here. One, I mean, you have to acknowledge that the Jews took the land from the people who had it by the command of God. Now, this was an act of judgment against those people by God for their immorality, but that point, I think, would not address the specific question of, in a sense, the theft of the land. All right?
Right.
So, I mean, however we answer this, if we're going to answer it biblically, we have to take into consideration that this kind of thing happened, and it was actually ordained by God himself. So I think it's going to be difficult to say that that such acts are implicitly wrong.
Well, can we say for the I'm not sure if you're going to build your argument on top of this, but can we say for just all intents and purposes that we don't base it on biblically? The friend that I was speaking to is actually someone who I'm trying to share the gospel with.
Right. He's just looking at the actions of this country themselves. I made that point partly because you had raised the biblical issue initially, you know, and also the issue of theft.
Right.
I have to go to break right now, but I want to hold you over because I want to talk a little bit more about this. And I'm actually not going to make an argument because it isn't like I have a real strong conviction about here's the right answer and here are the five reasons that I can give you that gets to my right answer. I think this is a little messier, but what I'm going to try to do is toss out some concepts that I think have to be taken into consideration whenever anyone wrestles with this issue, because I don't think it's quite as tidy as maybe your friend wants to make it sound, like the U.S. came and stole property from the Native Americans, and so that puts in question the entire enterprise from a moral perspective, okay? So hold with me here, Chris, and I'll come back to you. Let me make sure I hit the right button. That would be hold, and I'll be back in just a moment with more on Stand to Reason.
Looking for reliable information on current issues like same-sex marriage or embryonic stem cell research? Or you just in need of some clear thinking on something that has you confused? This is Greg Kokel with a suggestion about a quick way to get the knowledge you're searching for right now. Before you search the web, log on to str.org. You'll find sound analysis, careful commentary on the issues that challenge you as a Christian thinker, issues right out of the headlines, issues on the top of the list in public debate. Take a few moments to browse. Topics range from ethical issues like partial birth abortion to the theological debate about faith and works and everything in between. From our radio archives to advanced online training to our speakers, bios, and schedules, you'll find it easy to get the answers you're looking for. You'll come away from str.org with the accurately informed mind of a good ambassador for Christ. You'll also learn the tactics to help persuade others of the truth behind your convictions. And don't leave without registering as an ambassador. It's free, and it gives you complete access to everything on the site. I'm convinced that your visit to str.org will equip you, challenge you, and help you to take a stand for truth. Try it today. That's str.org.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800-2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. That's wild. Kind of like it, though. Let's go back to the phones, and Chris in Orange County is our caller, and we are talking about imperialism and whether imperialism is an act of theft. And so if the United States starts its enterprise by stealing land, doesn't that kind of cast into question all of its subsequent actions? Am I understanding this issue correctly here, Chris?
Yeah, and basically this has been an ongoing discussion with a friend of mine, whom I'm trying to share the gospel with.
But so this isn't part of the gospel part. This is something different, huh?
Yeah, well, he's starting to attack and question some of these things, you know, and this was one of the issues that came up.
Okay, I'm curious how I'll address the issue as best I can in a moment, but I'm curious how what is the relationship of the question of imperialism to the question of the gospel?
Well, I guess it's if really this country and its founders were built if they were
Christians,
if they held to this Christian ethic, then how is it that they could engage in this, and how can we even affirm this country as being built on Judeo-Christian philosophy?
Right. Well, the answer to that is actually rather simple, and it's the same reason that they could be. I think it's a matter of record that the worldview and the philosophy, if you will, the view of reality that informed their structuring the American project the way they did was the Bible. This is what these people, you look in their private writings and what their convictions were, what they wrote about, how they explained their point of view. I mean, this is thick through all the writings, and this has been quantified clearly. Even those who might have been deists in their personal convictions about the way God worked, were still being informed by a broadly put biblical worldview, an understanding of man and the nature of freedom and will and all those kinds of things. And this is why the particular words in the not the Constitution but the Declaration were the way they were. It was a deistic kind of grounding of the entire American act of rebellion and the subsequent building of the American project in a very, very particular way. It was fully informed by this. Now, having said that, it doesn't mean that everybody that was involved was a stellar Christian, a deeply committed follower of Christ that didn't falter in any way. I mean, you had founding fathers that were, that were adulterers, that owned slaves, and, all kinds of things. And you could look at individual lives of Christians then, just like you can look at individual lives of Christians now and find sin. I mean, if you followed me around for very long, you wouldn't have to follow me along for very long before you could find, some ugliness in my own life. So I think it's kind of a mistake to say these people couldn't have been informed by a Christian worldview in building this country if they did things like this that were unchristian. Because the fact is they were informed by that. We can tell by the nature of what they produced and also by their own writings and their thinking. And it was also true that they often did things that were not consistent ethically with Christianity. And that's just a description of the human condition. We don't live up to our highest ideals. So this is something, by the way, and since I know for you the more important question is the question of, the gospel for your friend, this is a condition that's actually predicted by the Christian worldview. It isn't at odds with Christianity. It is encompassed with Christianity. We need Christ precisely because of the kind of people we are. We are fallen people who are selfish and do what we want. We take what isn't ours. Forgiveness doesn't mean that it's now okay to do that. It means that there is a recourse for us from God's judgment because we are people that do those kinds of things. So we might argue, and that's another question we'll talk about in a minute, that this is inconsistent with their Christian worldview. But even if we did say that, it wouldn't follow from that the American enterprise wasn't grounded in a Christian understanding of the world and a Christian understanding of man. And it was not a noble thing in itself, even so, even though it's tarnished. I mean, human being, that's the human condition. So I would want to make that point with him.
Oh, and I think I've articulated that.
Yeah,
and
good
I've said
for you.
That there's no way that anybody could aspire or have an
accomplish.
To accomplish or do anything. I could never tell my son not to lie, not to steal, not to be dishonest, because I'm inconsistent with these values that I aspire to.
Right, right.
And I've told him that, but I think that we just kind of got stuck, and I got stuck as well.
Okay, well, let's go to the imperialism question, all right? The reason I don't think this is as tidy as some people want to make it, and what I mean by tidy is they say, we came in and stole the land from people that owned it before us, and so we were wrong for doing that, is because it's not entirely clear who owns any land.
Right.
I think more discussion has to be made about this, but let me just give you some illustrations. I'll tell you why I pause here. First of all, some of the land was purchased, and it was purchased at agreed upon price. Staten Island, I think, is probably the great example. A bag of beans, they got the whole island, which is now worth kabillions,
Right.
But at that time, those people paid, they had an agreement for that land. And so some of it's purchased, all right?
Right.
Some of it's wild. It didn't belong to anybody, there was room for expansion. It isn't like anybody held the title deed to the state of Texas, for example, or to Arkansas or that whole territory. The way things were done back then was that people powers expanded to take the thing, and it made and the people who fought the best got to keep the land. Now this wasn't the rule of just the white man. I just came back from our property in Wisconsin a week ago yesterday, and we've had this property since 1960. We built a cabin on it. It turns out to be on a reservation, Indian reservation. The property was purchased from the Indians who gave it, but we're still within the confines of the reservation. And so there in Lac du Flambeau, Wisconsin, you have the Great Lakes Chippewa, or as they prefer to be called, the Ojibwa. And that is the kind of the predominant tribe in that whole part of the country. And actually further, a little bit further west. Now, I just read again a pamphlet that I've had for a while that was printed by the town of Lac du Flambeau. You know, as a tourist attraction, and they have the powwows and the this and that and whatever. And so they have these pamphlets that explain the background history. And I just read it again a couple of weeks ago. And what it says is that for 300 years, there were bloody wars. These are not my terms, but the terms in the pamphlet, between the Great Lakes Chippewa and the Sioux, because the Great Lakes Chippewa had come down from Canada to occupy these lands that were then occupied by the Sioux. And they fought them, and they beat them after 300 years of bloody warfare and drove the Sioux out. And now it belonged to the Ojibwa. The Sioux went west. Now, when the white man comes in and takes it away from the Ojibwa, and then they cry foul, you have to give us land back, you got to pay us or whatever. Now, it seems to me, on the grand scheme of things, what sauce for the goose should be sauce for the gander. They stole it from somebody before them, and I suspect that the Sioux moved in on some other people that were there before them, because that's the way this kind of thing happens. And, you know, can you, you know, move into the property and, you know, live peaceably together? I imagine you could. There's more room. There's room for more people, but it was these people claimed it for themselves just by raw fiat, and that in order to take it, have land for yourself when others want to expand, they have to beat the people that have claimed it by raw fiat, not by any, in a sense, legitimate claim to the land. I'm not even sure what that is. What is a legitimate claim to the land? I guess if somebody has their piece of property and they work that piece of property, then they build something, they create some wealth, and that wealth that they build and create is their own. But the land wasn't built and created by those people. They were just going in there and hunting it. So I think what this raises is legitimate questions as to whose property it was anyway. And the Americans, when they came in, were just simply following the fashion of everybody else in the world, including the people they supplanted, who had done the very same thing to the ones who came before them. And so here I am in Lac du Flambeau on the reservation, ceded to these people by the government, and they continue to get massive amounts of aid as a payback, when I don't think one dime is going of that money is going from the Ojibwa to the Sioux. Because they had taken the land from them prior to it.
I guess the question, though, that comes from that is it right, though?
Well, I don't know. I mean, and I don't know what the alternative is. I don't think it's right to take something that belongs to somebody else. But I think the question is, what is it that belonged to the Native Americans? The land? And if it did belong to that particular tribe that we took it from, that some white men took it from, then why did it belong to them? Well, it belonged to them, pardon me, because they stole it from somebody else. So can you steal from a thief? And is it still theft? Is that land rightfully there? And that's the kind of thing that I think makes this a very tricky situation.
Yeah. Well, is this land ours now? I mean, could we even say that as well?
Yes.
Could we say that? That America is ours now. If that's where it seems like.
Yes, I think so. Certainly, it can, but partly because we invested ourselves in it and toil, and we made something of it that wasn't here before, and so we created capital wealth. And if you take a stick, maybe the stick laying on the ground isn't yours; it's anybody's who wants to pick it up. But if you pick that stick up and you whittle it into a tool, then that tool is yours, because you have added, you've created some value to it. Just because its stick is on the ground doesn't make it yours. But if you add your labor to it and make something new of it, that which you've made is yours, and that's what should not be taken from you. That would be theft. But I don't know why. What if I just walked out and say, I claim all the sticks in the ground, and if you take any of those that I claim, then you're stealing from me. What right do I have to that?
No, I agree.
So, again, I'm not, you know, arguing in favor of imperialism at this point or colonization. I'm just simply saying that, you know, I think that other questions have to be answered before you can kind of put the finger on the American colonists here. And and there's a lot of blame to go around, and I think they were simply playing by the rules of the day. And if you're playing by the same rules every – maybe this is a way of thinking about it. If you're playing by the same rules everyone else is playing by, then how can you be faulted? I mean, it really was the same rules that everyone else was playing by, including the Native Americans.
Right.
Now, there might have been a few exceptions to that, but there are exceptions on both sides of the aisle on this. So that's why I can't – there is – I don't think the answer is, okay, we got to pay them back for what we took from them. I think that's nonsense.
Oh, no, I agree. I think both of us came to the same conclusion as well.
Well, that's good.
But it was just, I don't know, I guess it was, I guess it was missing the part where if I took something. I think that your stick analogy was really good.
Yeah.
I didn't have that point.
Right.
So would we say then back in history, they were playing by the rules, but I mean, that wouldn't necessarily make it right, but we could say that.
Well, I don't know what was right. I honestly don't know what was right in those circumstances. That's what I mean. Sometimes we have this thing called the tyranny of the present, where we take our sensibilities of the present state of affairs and we try to import them into the past or export them into the past and make them apply to a set of circumstances that weren't like that at all. I mean, a lot of people think, oh, well, Paul, he was a terrible chauvinist pig, you know, the Apostle Paul, oh, he was awful. But when you read his writings in the context of the times, he was a liberator in the context of the times. And I think that's the way we have to read these things. There was a set of rules that everybody played by, and there was tacit agreement to those rules. So they aren't the rules that we play by today. But we were playing by the rules that everybody else was playing by, so it didn't seem to me that we were doing anything wrong. I mean, that argument could be made.
Okay.
And I guess I'm more comfortable with that kind of argument than saying, yeah, well, we've got this thing now, you know, where everybody's nice, and we don't take things from people. And weren't we bad when we did that back then? I don't know. I'm not so convinced of that. So, you know, and with regards to colonizing, you know, and I'm thinking that could have been – that often was a brutal process. The imperialism of the European powers, I think, was often brutal. But you know what? An argument could be made that even though that happened and there were brutal elements to it, the people in general turned out to be much better off under Western domination than ruling themselves. And we learned this the hard way when all in the 60s, all those African nations got their independence and then they just went around butchering each other.
Right.
So in India is a much better place now because it had British rule. You know, I mean, I'm convinced of that. So, you know, it's just these kinds of accusations are not as tidy as some people want to make them seem.
Okay. No, I appreciate that. I think that's given me enough to go on. I do like the stick thing to make a lot of sense.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Thanks, right. Chris.
Thanks
appreciate.
A lot.
Yeah. Appreciate okay. Your call. I remember when I went fishing down in Mexico, and down in the freshwaters there, you know, they have a lot of reservoirs up in the hills and thereabouts, and they serve the needs of the people, but. They're just big bodies of water that some American businessmen and fishermen realized that they might make something more of. And so they invested their capital and planted tilapia down there, which is a kind of a panfish. It's St. Peter's fish. It was the kind of panfish that you can get in the Sea of Galilee. And then planted a bunch of largemouth bass down there. And the tilapia, you know, grew and reproduced and became a forage base for the largemouth bass that grew and reproduced and grew really big. And then there was a tourist opportunity so that people could go down to Mexico and spend their money down there at the places that these investors had set up on the lakes. So these investors make a profit too, to then go fish on these lakes and catch the fish and bring American money into the local economy and give jobs to the local people as guides and workers and everything else. And it was a great thing until the people started putting nets out to net all of the tilapia for commercial use, and in the process netted a bunch of bass along with it. So, and the argument was, it's our lake, not yours. Well, the fact is, it was their lake before and they did nothing with it. And then the American investors invested in such a way as to create a capital benefit so that wealth was created and wealth then flowed into the local community, something they hadn't done. Now I think it could be properly said that those Mexican locals were stealing from the American businessmen, because the American businessmen created something that everybody in the community was benefiting from. Anyway, and they allowed the nets. They just wanted them to be careful with them. But anyway, that to me kind of is parallel to this circumstance we were just talking about. All right, when we come back, we'll talk about whether Jesus is the eternal Son, and I don't know what else is up there, but we'll have some fun conversation. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Don't go away.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
Now, this is the enforcer's choice, I know.
It's
this is Carpenters.
Sometime this time to get myself in shape.
Greg Kokel. Stand to Reason. Let's go back to the callers, and the enforcer's doing karaoke on the other side of the glass there. Let's move ahead, please. And Tim in Bar Harbor, Maine. Welcome back to the show, Tim.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. Thanks
welcome
for taking my call.
Sure. I appreciate your patience here, because it took us a while to get to you.
Yeah, it's a good thing to listen to while I'm waiting. so you can remember where I'm coming from. I am a believer in the Trinity.
Right.
So the question I have is about the nature of Jesus before he's on Earth.
That would be the nature of the Son then, because Jesus was the one that was on Earth.
Yes.
Just
yes.
A little detail.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Was he the Son from eternity past?
Yeah.
Did he always exist in the Trinity as the Son?
Yeah, this is this is one of those refined theological discussions that that create a lot of heat among certain types, you know. And I know that's not your interest, but you want to get my opinion on it. The question is whether Jesus or the second person of the Trinity was eternally the Son, or was he simply the Son when the second person of the Trinity became incarnate as a man?
Yeah.
And a lot of people obviously believe and they hold that it's orthodox to hold that Jesus was eternally the Son. He was always in this sonship relationship with the Father. And part of the reason they say is, well, a father can't be a father without a son. And so God was eternally the Father, so therefore the Son must have been eternally the Son. I know people like John MacArthur, as solid and as conservative and as reformed as John MacArthur, I think, have repudiated this notion, taken a lot of fire for it. And I read a piece he wrote once, and he's kind of shrugging. He said, hey, what's the big deal? It's not like I'm denying the Trinity. This is my view is a legitimate position. So, I think that those who hold to eternal sonship are going to say that in the social Trinity, that is the relationships between the members of the Trinity, the sonship relationship is an eternal relationship because the Son is eternally proceeding from the Father. This has to do with the basic nature of the relationships. And what makes the Father and the Son is this eternally proceeding from the Father. And that's one of those things in the social Trinity that distinguishes the Son from the Father. Because I think it's fair to ask some people, say, what's the difference between the Father and the Son? If they're both eternal beings and have all the nature qualities of deity, well, there is a difference in this regard, that the Son is proceeding from the Father and the Father's not proceeding from anyone. And so there's a genuine distinction there that helps to solidify this distinction of the persons, this real distinction of the persons. And so this is why they're going to want to, you know, stand pretty firm on that, because it is one of the elements that makes this real distinction coherent. So I know Melinda's been reading a book by Fred Sanders. We've had Fred on the show before, and he's lectured for us before. And his specialty is in the area of the Trinity. I'm going to give you the title here, so it's a little bit long and burdensome, but it can be found at Amazon.com. But here it is, Jesus in Trinitarian Perspective. And subtitled, An Introductory Christology. But if you look up Fred Sanders, Fred Barnes, the other guy,
Fred Sanders,
S-A-N-D-E-R-S, okay. And that's Jesus in Trinitarian Perspective, and you're going to get a very adequate characterization of this issue there. I actually don't take a stand on it. To me, I'm not interested in it. Well, I just don't care about it. You know,
yeah.
I'm not saying that it's not a weighty issue. It may be, but it hasn't really showed up on my radar as such yet. The enforcer seemed pretty adamant. She studied this issue quite a bit more than I have, and she seems to think it's weightier than I do, and she could very well be right.
Yeah. Well, for the people then who don't hold the eternal sonship of Christ type view, then what would Jesus have existed as? The Word?
The Word would be as a biblical characterization.
Okay.
A simple descriptive term would be the second person of the Trinity.
All right.
But the Word is the way the Scripture itself describes
sure.
the second person. So who we call the second person.
Well, the one final question on that, for those then who would hold the eternal Son view, is in Hebrews 1, when God is saying, you are my Son, today I have become your Father, would they say that this is speaking of when Jesus... appearance on earth when he becomes incarnate.
Yeah, let me ask, they would say that about that, but let me ask you about your interpretation or your translation. Was that the New International Version?
Yes, it was.
Gosh, see, this is why I don't like the New International Version.
What do you like? What's your...
Well, because it doesn't say, today I've become your Father. It says, today I've begotten you.
Okay. What version do you use?
New American Standard.
New American Standard?
Yes, and begotten. See, they take the concept of begottenness there, and then they interpret it as becoming the Father of. Notice how in their translation they insert a theological point of view. Are you listening to this, Enforcer? Melinda, I want you, the New International Version translates Hebrews 1 as, today I have become your Father, instead of today I have begotten you. In other words, they insert a theological interpretation, a rather bold one, it seems to me, in their translation. So what you as a reader don't realize is that this is an interpretation, not a translation, at this particular point. The New American Standard says, today I have begotten thee. And the question itself is whether begottenness is an eternal relationship or whether begottenness is a temporal relationship, whether Jesus becomes the Son at the Incarnation or whether Jesus is eternally the begotten Son of God, that he is eternally proceeding from the Father, which would be the nature of his begottenness. Not that he's created, obviously, and NIV doesn't imply that, but that does it does state, actually, in its translation, that that the Father became the Father of the Son, Jesus, at the Incarnation. But that is this debate, and I think they have done us a disservice by weighing in on that one in their translation in a way that we can't see that they have editorialized there in their translation.
Okay.
And I have seen other places where they've done this, and it's bothered me.
Okay, so the New American Standard, that would be the best standard, you think, the best?
I think that that's my Bible. That's the New American Standard translates it as it was written. Now, it's a little bit more wooden in its reading, but that's partly because they try to stay a little closer. They don't do as much interpreting.
I'd never actually even thought that begotten would have been that the word begotten would have been that important of a word. But
the thing is the concept of begottenness and what that means is what's at stake in this discussion.
Yes,
and so that's why, you know, the way they translate that word is important. They should have just left it neutral. Okay, I got to run. Tim,
well, thank you very much.
Good talking to you.
Okay,
thanks for the call. Let's go to San Diego, and John. John, welcome to the show.
Hey, how you doing, Greg?
Good, thanks.
Greg, I'm going to ask you a question, but before I do, have you ever heard of a Christmas Calvinist?
A Christmas calendar?
No, a Christmas Calvinist.
Oh, no, I haven't.
No L.
No limited atonement.
Exactly.
Did you hear? Okay, Melinda put up here that you're a four-point Calvinist.
Well, my question was about four-point Calvinism.
Oh, okay.
But I just real quick, where I got that Noel from was R.C. Sproul was telling the story how he was at a conference and someone came up to him one day and asked him if he knew what a Christmas Calvinist was.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty funny.
And he didn't know. But anyway, my question was this. Now, you defined earlier limited atonement. The way I understand it, I've heard it two ways, where Christ is, as you put it, efficient for all, but sufficient for all, but efficient for only some.
Correct.
Okay, meaning Christ. Okay, and the other way I've heard it, now this is where people struggle with it, is when they say Christ paid for the sins only of the elect.
Yes.
And only their sins.
Yes.
Now, which side did you really fall on?
The second statement is simply a variation of the first. To say that he paid for the sins of the elect and only for their sins is another way of saying that he is efficient only for the elect. That's exactly what that means, and this is why I went through that long character, and I think very careful and precise characterization that was meant to show that payment means payment, and therefore if he paid for everyone, then everyone's sins would be paid for and there would be no sins for them to pay for, and therefore they would all go to heaven. Universalism.
Well, Craig, the way I've heard the second part put is because Christ is the creator and he's greater than all that exists, his sacrifice was sufficient to pay for anybody's sins that would possibly ask him to be their savior.
It was sufficient for anyone, even for those people who didn't ask him.
Right,
but it is not efficient for them. It is only applied to those who fulfill the requirements.
Exactly.
It's only intended for the ones who fulfill the requirements. So it's limited in that sense.
But in that sense also, it seems like at least there's a possibility for everybody to be saved. But in the other way, where Christ only paid for the sins of those he came to save, it seems like those who weren't chosen don't even have the possibility of salvation. And how would you answer that?
Well, I think that's the way that's put is a distortion of the concept. Keep in mind that whoever fulfills the requirement will receive the benefit. That's it. And so everyone has that legitimate offer, but people will not. They will not. And so since they will not, then they must pay for that themselves. Those who will only will to do so because God has mercifully acted on their behalf to change their nature so that now instead of rebelling, they have an inclination towards towards God, and then they choose freely, in the sense that I described, to follow him, and therefore that it applies to him. And then the payment is applied to him, and it is only applied to them. See, it isn't like, you know, the mistake that people make is they think of the blood of Christ like $1 million. And let's say there are $2 million worth of sins out there, but but there's only $1 million worth of payment. And so that $1 million goes to just those people who believed, and there's nothing left over for anyone else. So even if they wanted to believe, then they wouldn't be paid. Then they couldn't be forgiven, because there's no cash left for them, so to speak.
Exactly.
But that's the wrong way to look at it. It's not a quantity. It's a quality. Jesus created an eternal quality. He was the God-man. And so, in principle, that's what we mean when we say it's sufficient for everyone. There's plenty of there to go around. But it is only intended for those who fulfill the requirement, and it is only applied to those who fulfill the requirement, and therefore only those who fulfill the requirement have their sins paid for, and the others don't have their sins paid for because they didn't fulfill the requirement. Now, the requirement is faith.
But there was still plenty left over if they would have chosen.
Yeah, if you want to use those terms. But even when you say plenty left over, there's, and I think that might have been my phrase, that kind of suggests that the quantity model, and I don't think it's the quantity model. But there is no lack of available grace in terms or of available power or salvific capability in the work of Christ that couldn't cover even the sins of people who don't believe. That's available there. It's just they do not appropriate it for themselves, and therefore it's never applied to them.
Hey, Greg, one last thing. I'll take it over to the air. Can you really briefly describe the two types of liberty you described earlier?
Yeah.
One more time? Thank you.
Okay, one more time on this, and thank you for the call, John. Was it John? Yeah, John. It doesn't sound like he's from San Diego. It sounds like he's from New Jersey. There are two ways that an act can be free. An act can be free if it fulfills one condition, and that is that it's done by us, and that it's a result of our will and volition. If we choose it, then it's our choice. That's the only requirement of the first kind, and that's the way we sin. The requirement of the second kind is that in addition to the first, it also must be the case that we could have done otherwise. If not, then it's not free. The first version is sometimes called compatibilism, and the second is sometimes called libertarian freedom. I think both apply in our lives, but I think only the first applies to the sin question, which is why God must rescue us from ourselves. A last call very, very quickly here. Is this Caleb in Waterloo, Iowa?
Yeah.
Hello, Caleb.
Hi. I first want to thank you for being such a faithful servant and just the way God's used you in my life to help further my spiritual walk.
Well, I'm very glad to do so. Thanks.
Last year, I purchased the Ambassador's Curriculum, and I've really enjoyed it a lot.
Good.
I had a small question from the Tactics Part 1 introduction.
Yeah, we just have about 2 minutes left.
Okay. You were talking to that lady that was a Wicca, and
yes,
she said she wouldn't want to do anything harmful because it would come back on her,
right,
like karma.
Yeah.
And I wanted your thoughts on that. I mean, to me, the sowing and reaping principle that we see in Galatians 6,
yes,
kind of sounds like karma, but perhaps it's not.
Okay, it isn't. Both the sowing and reaping in Galatians 6, which actually has to do principally with giving to the ministry, but basically you sow to the flesh, you reap destruction. You sow to the spirit, you reap eternal life. Both that and the karma, what goes around comes around, are consequentialist notions. That means there are actions we take and certain consequences follow from it. But they are grounded completely differently, because in the Christian view, it is God that is rewarding or punishing in our actions. There are consequences, but it's part of a justice system that a person grounds, and we're offending a person and we pay to him. In the karma system, there is no person. There is this kind of loose system of you do good, then good happens, and if you do bad, then bad happens. But it's tied into a reincarnation notion and to an idea that ultimately God is not personal at all, and it's the whole Eastern kind of mindset. So though there are similarities in that they are both have consequentialist in terms of their notions, they're coming from a completely different system. So it's almost like saying, well, you got a carburetor on an airplane and you got a carburetor on a submarine. Okay, well, they're both carburetors, but they run completely different engines, if you will. And so though there are some similarities, the differences are pretty dramatic, and that's what matters here. It is not karma being taught there because God's involved in the equation. Thanks so much for the call, Caleb, and I'm glad Stand to Reason was able to help you out. That's it for today, friends. I'll be back next week. In the meantime, make it a point to be a good ambassador for Christ. It is the Christ Jesus that you represent. And I'll talk to you next week. In the meantime, you all go out and give them heaven. Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye, friends.